Welcome to The End of Innocence, the JFK assassination. I'm your host, John Young. Over the last six episodes, we've peeled back the layers of the J.D. Tippit murder, examining witness statements, the strange circumstances surrounding Oswald's identification, and the explosive claims by Aquila Clemons and Frank Wright that two men may have been involved in the murder of J.D. Tippit. We also explored the bizarre case of Warren Reynolds, the witness who was shot in the head and later changed his testimony to identify Lee Harvey Oswald as the person he saw running from the scene of Tippit's murder. And we question whether the timeline of the shooting even allows for Oswald to be the killer of J.D. Tippit. We looked at the mysterious jacket found in a parking lot behind the Ballot Texaco station, the multiple wallets allegedly belonging to Oswald, the ballistic evidence, and Tippit's final movements while alive on this earth. Have you noticed the deeper we go, the more the official story begins to unravel? Just eight blocks from the site where Officer J.D. Tippit was gunned down stands the Texas Theater at 231 West Jefferson Boulevard. Still open today, it's remembered most for one historic moment, the arrest of Lee Harvey Oswald. But Oswald's capture is only the beginning. Today on The End of Innocence, we step inside the Texas Theater and examine witness accounts from that fateful afternoon. What time did Oswald arrive at the theater? Where did he sit? On the first floor or in the balcony? Did he speak to anyone while in the theater? Was there a possible second Oswald spotted in the theater at the same time? How many arrests were made that day in the theater? And was Jack Ruby, infamous in his own right, spotted in the theater also? We'll dig into those questions and more as we move closer to answering the ultimate mystery. Who really killed Officer J.D. Tippit? According to the Warren Report, after killing Officer Tippit, Lee Oswald cut through the yard of Virginia and Barbara Davis, then walked past William Scoggins' cab and headed south on Patton. Lee Oswald hurried south on Patton and passed within 60 feet of Ted Calloway, manager of Harris Brothers Auto Sales. Calloway had run out to the sidewalk after hearing what he said was five shots coming from the direction of 10th and Patton. Calloway was on the east side of Patton and saw Lee Harvey Oswald holding a pistol in his hand on the west side of Patton. He said, "Hey man, what the hell is going on?" He said Oswald said something to him, but he couldn't make out what he said. Oswald then passed and turned right on West Jefferson Boulevard. Calloway noticed Oswald's white Eisenhower-type jacket and white t-shirt. When shown the brown shirt worn by Oswald when he was arrested, Calloway told the Warren Commission, quote, "Sir, when I saw him, he didn't have on that shirt," end quote. He noticed Oswald's face was very flushed and he had dark hair. Calloway said the shots he heard fired that day occurred at close to 1 p.m. He knew this because he had just gotten back from lunch. Calloway then states, quote, "After the man passed me and turned right onto Jefferson, I ran around on 10th Street and saw a police officer lying in the street. He looked dead to me. I got the officer's gun and hollered at the cab driver to come on. We might catch this man who shot Officer Tippit. We got into his cab number 213, and we drove up Patton to Jefferson and looked all around, but we could not see the man," end quote. Sam Ginyard, who worked as a partner for Calloway, told the police he heard shots close to 1 p.m. and he saw a white man running south on Patton with a pistol in his hand. He states, quote, "The last I saw of this man, he was running west on Jefferson," end quote. Warren Reynolds saw a man run south on Patton towards Jefferson Street and then walk at a fast rate of speed west on Jefferson. He last observed the individual turn north by the Ballet Texaco station. When later shown a photograph of Oswald, Reynolds said he would hesitate to identify Oswald as the individual he saw. L.J. Lewis, standing beside Reynolds, observed the same man and said, quote, "He would hesitate to state whether the individual was identical with Oswald," end quote. Harold Russell and B.M. Patterson were with Reynolds and Lewis at the time of the shooting. They identified the individual they saw as Oswald from a photograph. The men wearing a white t-shirt and jacket hurried west on Jefferson and passed the Ballou Texaco station. Mary Brock said an individual with a light complexion and wearing light clothing walked past her at a fast pace with his hands in his pocket. 5 minutes later, Reynolds and Patterson appeared at the station making inquiry as to whether she had noticed a man pass the station. She advised that she last saw the individual when he proceeded north behind the station. Mrs. Brock identified the individual as Lee Oswald from a New Orleans police photograph, but not until 10 months after the shooting. According to the Warren report, Tippit's killer discarded a light-colored jacket underneath a 1954 Oldsmobile in the parking lot behind the Ballet Texaco station. This left him wearing only a white t-shirt. The jacket, soon found by police, was later described as a gray man's jacket, size medium. As a side note, all of Lee Oswald's other shirts and jackets were size small. There were numerous laundry marks in the collar of the jacket. On the bottom of the jacket was a laundry tag, B-9738. The cleaning tags and laundry marks noted on the inside of the jacket suggest it was professionally cleaned on several occasions. The FBI examined all of Oswald's other clothing and failed to find a single laundry mark or tag on any of them. Marina told the FBI that Lee Oswald only had two jackets, one a heavy jacket, blue in color, and another light gray jacket. She said both of these jackets were purchased in Russia. Neither of these jackets were ever sent to any laundry or cleaners anywhere, she recalled. She always washed them herself. I did an interview back on October 25, 1997, with Officer Gerald Hill, who was in charge of Tippit's shooting investigation. Hill told me that the jacket found at the Tippit slaying, which was believed to be Oswald's, bared certain laundry marks, which was traced to a dry cleaner in Washington, D.C. What does all that mean? Where did this jacket come from? It was the jacket that contained bullets from supposedly Oswald's revolver, but their big mistake was leaving the laundry tags that were traced to Washington. Was this just another example of the sloppy job they did in covering up this horrible crime? J.D. Tippit's assailant then continued down Jefferson Boulevard and was next seen at 213 Jefferson by Johnny Brewer at 1:30 p.m. Brewer, a manager at Hardy's Shoe Store, was listening to news reports about the president's assassination when he heard reports that a Dallas police officer, J.D. Tippit, had just been killed a few blocks away. A man whose behavior seemed suspicious then walked into the foyer of the shoe store. Brewer said that the man stared at all the displays in the window and acted scared as police cars with blaring sirens raced by. After the last squad car passed in one direction, the man stepped out of the store and walked in the opposite direction toward the Texas Theater.
Johnny, when was the first time you saw Lee Harvey Oswald?
Saw him that Friday afternoon, November 22nd. He walked into the lobby of a store.
How far in did he walk out there, John?
A few feet. He was standing right about where those tennis shoes are right there, just about 5 feet from the door there.
What made you suspicious of this man who walked into the lobby?
Well, right after the president had been shot, they broadcast a description on the radio. This man, 5'8", 5'9", 150 pounds, and this Oswald matched the description. And just a few minutes before he walked into the lobby, on the radio they had a bulletin that an officer had been shot here in Oak Cliff. And he walked in, he matched the description. Looked scared the way he stood there.
You were standing right here behind the counter?
Standing right here behind the counter listening to the radio.
And where did he walk to? How far into the lobby did he come?
He walked right into the right-hand side of the lobby there, just a few feet from the door, and stood there looking in at the shoes there.
Were there a lot of police cars in the area?
Yeah, there was a lot of police cars. There were some cars coming up Jefferson Street. They made that U-turn there and went back down Jefferson. And when they did, Oswald turned and walked up to the theater.
It's at this point where I believe reality set in for Lee Harvey Oswald. I believe Oswald was scared at this point. He begins to realize the full implications of this thing. I think for the first time all day, he realizes that he was being set up to take the fall for this entire event. He goes into the Texas Theater, possibly his prearranged meeting point. Though he has $14 in his pocket, he does not buy the 75-cent ticket. Mr. Brewer states, quote, "The police cars were racing up and down Jefferson with their sirens blasting, and it appeared to me that this guy was hiding from them. He waited until there was a break in the activity, and then he headed west until he got to the Texas Theater. I left the shoe store and followed him to the theater and asked the lady who sold tickets, Julia Postal, if she had sold a ticket to the guy. She said that she hadn't, and I told her the guy must have snuck in and that she should call the police. That's the only report the police got before they sent 15 police cars to surround the theater. And even though the Dallas police have an admirable concern for the protection of property, they usually would have held back a few police cars in reserve, even for the type of criminal who would go into the theater without a ticket. Now, this has to be the most remarkable example of police intuition in the history of law enforcement, but I don't buy it. They knew, someone knew, Oswald was going to be there. And just for the record, Mr. Brewer did not actually see Oswald go through the doors and into the theater. Brewer continues to say, quote, "I went into the theater and spoke to Butch Burroughs, the assistant manager. He told me that the guy who had come in had gone up to the balcony. I went up to the balcony to have a look. It was dark up there and I couldn't see anyone, so I went back downstairs and told Butch to keep his eyes on the front exit. I went to the back door and waited for the police to arrive," end quote. Brewer states, quote, "I heard some noise outside in the back alley and opened the door. A Dallas police officer grabbed my arm and threw me up against the door. Another officer grabbed my arm and started to frisk me. Boy, was I scared, and I told them that I was the one who had Julia Postal call them and that the man they wanted was still in the theater. They brought me back in and we walked out on the stage in front of the screen. The movie never stopped running, but someone turned up the house lights and I pointed to a guy who was sitting near the back of the theater, about three rows from the rear and to my left. The police started walking up the aisle from the front of the theater, telling everyone they passed to leave and get out of the way until they got the man I had pointed out to them," end quote. When the police arrived in the alley behind the theater, Captain C.E. Talbert noticed a young man standing beside a pickup truck with the engine running. Officers questioned the young man and searched the pickup, but made no police reports about the incident. Talbert testified before the Warren Commission, but at no time in over 20 pages of testimony was he asked, nor did he volunteer anything about the Texas Theater, Oswald's arrest, or any young man in the alley. We will probably never know the name of this man, nor will we know what he was doing in the alley while Oswald was hiding in the balcony. The plan may have been to kill Oswald inside the dark theater, if and when Oswald pointed his .38 revolver at the police. By the way, that .38 revolver had a defective firing pin. But the one thing the conspirators could not control was the number of potential witnesses, both civilian and police. Too many witnesses would make killing Oswald inside a theater difficult, if not impossible. Listen up, this is real important. Johnny Brewer's story matches the official version, but Butch Burroughs, a reliable eyewitness, places Lee Oswald in the Texas Theater by as early as 1:07 p.m. Yes, 1:07 p.m., approximately 10 minutes before the Tippit shooting. Burroughs saw Oswald from the candy counter around 1:07 or 1:08 p.m. According to Butch, he went up in the balcony. If Oswald had gone straight down Zang Boulevard by car or bus to Jefferson Boulevard, he could have easily made it to the Texas Theater before 1:10 p.m. At 1:15, Oswald came downstairs and Butch showed him some popcorn. Keep in mind, this is around the exact time Tippit is shot seven blocks away. After buying popcorn, Oswald then went into the theater on the ground level and sat next to a pregnant woman. Several minutes later, the woman got up and went upstairs to the ladies' restroom. Butch did not see her leave and never saw her again. So is Lee Oswald in the Texas Theater buying popcorn between 1:07 and 1:10 p.m., or is he at the corner of 10th and Patton shooting J.D. Tippit? Once again, Lee Oswald is in two places at the same time. How could this happen? Butch Burroughs' recollections are confirmed by another witness, 18-year-old Jack Davis. Davis sat in the right rear of the theater. As the opening credits for the movie were ending at a few minutes past one, Lee Oswald startled Davis by squeezing by him and sitting down next to him in a theater with 900 seats and fewer than 20 patrons. Oswald said nothing to him, and after a few minutes got up and moved across the aisle and sat down next to another person. He got up again at 1:15 to buy his popcorn. Davis then saw Oswald enter the center section of the theater from the far side. Burroughs and Davis agreed that the police arrived at the theater about 20 minutes after the popcorn purchase. Here's Butch Burroughs talking about seeing Lee Oswald in the theater that day.
We were playing two movies called Lord as Hell with Audie Murphy and Cry Battle with Van Heflin. And we started the movie at 1 o'clock. And I was counting candy behind the candy case. And he also slipped in around between 1 and 17.
It would be helpful if there was a way to know what all of the witnesses who were in the theater that day had to say, not just Jack Davis. But unfortunately, none of the witnesses gave statements to the FBI or Warren Commission about what they saw, and they've been really hard to track down. But in 1998, at of all things a school function for one of my sons, I was speaking with a man who was asking me about my research into the assassination. We knew each other and he was aware I was a researcher. He said to me, "By the way, you need to speak with my uncle who lives in Dallas." He was in the theater the day that Oswald was arrested. And what's funny is his story doesn't match up with what you hear on the documentaries about what happened that day in the theater. So to make a long story short, I was able to contact his uncle and conduct an interview with him about what he saw that day in the theater. Mr. Alpike would then proceed to tell me an incredible story. He was sitting in the theater's balcony a few minutes after 1 p.m., and a young man who he always thought was Lee Harvey Oswald came and sat next to him in the balcony of the theater. He thought it was strange that the man sat next to him because the balcony only had like 3 to 4 people up there, and there was a ton of empty seats, and the man sat right next to him. He said it actually made him feel uncomfortable. After a few minutes, he said the man asked him if he had some bazooka bubble gum, and he said, "Excuse me?" So the man asked him again, and he said, "I said no, I do not have any bazooka bubble gum." As soon as I said that, the man got up and went and sat next to another person that was several seats down. He hears the man say something to that person he sat next to, but could not make out what he said. He estimates that about 15 or 20 minutes go by, and he hears some commotion from the lower section of the theater. He hears people shouting and a man yelling, "I'm not resisting arrest." He then says two police officers then come up to the balcony and go to the young man that was just a few minutes ago sitting next to him. And the man calmly gets up and leaves the balcony with the police officers. He stands up to see what's going on and he sees the police officers take the young man at the rear exit of the theater. He would see Lee Harvey Oswald later on the news, and he told his wife that he witnessed the arrest of Oswald. He said that the man was sitting next to him was Lee Harvey Oswald, or an exact double. I told him, and by now he knew the official story, but he tells me the official story is a lie. He said, "I was in the balcony with Oswald, and he was taken from the balcony by two Dallas police officers, and there was no struggle like they said it was." He said, "I will go to my grave knowing that it was Lee Harvey Oswald that was in the balcony that day, and he was led out of there by two police officers." So what is the truth here? We've talked about the idea of two Oswalds already on several episodes of this podcast. As you study and research his case, there are instances in the record of people saying that they saw Oswald who seemed convinced of it, but their sightings are at times when Oswald's presence is already indisputably accounted for in the record. For example, Ralph Yates, the guy who was sent to the asylum, said he picked up a hitchhiker who looked just like Oswald and was saying things that would be incriminating for Oswald. Go back and listen to episode 10 to hear Mr. Yates' incredible story. Another example is Sterling Wood and his father seeing the man who looked just like Oswald at the gun range on a day that Oswald was with his family and Ruth Payne at the Payne house. The other big example that we've looked at in detail is when multiple witnesses saw a man who looked like Oswald running down the hill in Dealey Plaza to get into a Nash Rambler station wagon after the assassination. Go back and listen to episode 9 to hear the complete account. Also, we have the account from Mr. John Thomas, who I interviewed years ago. He said that he saw both Oswalds on a city bus, almost at the same time, just a couple of weeks before the assassination. He spoke with both men on the bus that day. So now we have another one of those potential double Oswald sightings at the Texas Theater. The mystery has to do with which exit Oswald was taking out of the theater by police after his arrest. There is also some confusion as to why some parts of the official record state that Oswald was discovered in the balcony and not the main floor of the theater. The official story, which I believe is correct, is that Oswald was taken out the front door. There is a famous photo of Oswald struggling with police as he is taken out the front door, which resolves the issue alone. Numerous statements from officers that day, including Sergeant Hill, also support the idea that Oswald exited the Texas Theater through the lobby and then the front door. But if it really isn't disputed that Oswald went out the front door, then why are there three witnesses who say they saw Oswald taken out the back door of the theater? According to Butch Burroughs, who sold Oswald popcorn at 1:15, he saw a second arrest with the suspect taken out the back of the theater. In an interview with Jim Douglas, Burroughs said that the Dallas police arrested, quote, an Oswald lookalike, end quote, 3 or 4 minutes after they arrested Oswald and took him out the front. Burroughs said he could see the second man just as well as he could see Oswald, and that the man, quote, looked identical to Oswald, end quote. Bernard Hare, who owned Bernie's Hobby Shop, which was two doors down from the Texas Theater, also saw an arrest happen in the back of the theater. Hare was in the front of the theater at first, but he couldn't see what was going on because of the crowd. So he went back through his store into the alley out back. The alley was full of police cars, but there were fewer spectators. There in the back alley, Hare witnessed what he thought for years was the arrest of Lee Harvey Oswald. He said he saw two police officers bring out a young man who was a spitting image of Lee Harvey Oswald. It wasn't until 1987 that Hare found out that Oswald had been taken out the front of the theater. Al Pike told me in an interview in December 1998 that he sat next to Lee Harvey Oswald in the balcony and saw him led out of the balcony by two Dallas police officers a few minutes after hearing some commotion from the lower level, which apparently was the arrest of the real Lee Harvey Oswald. So from the stories of Bernard Hare, Butch Burrows, and Al Pike, there is some evidence for the idea that another person who resembled Oswald was taken out the back door after being arrested. But is there any documentation to support the idea of an Oswald look-alike being arrested and taken out the back of the theater? Well, yes, there is. In the official homicide report for J.D. Tippit, it says, quote, "Suspect was later arrested in the balcony of the Texas Theater," end quote. Dallas Police Detective L.D. Strangfellow said in a letter to Captain Canaway that is now in the Dallas City Archives that, quote, "Oswald was arrested in the balcony of the Texas Theater," end quote. You can now easily find this report online. Assassination researchers for years believed that the Oswald look-alike is the one who was arrested in the balcony and taken out the back of the theater. You may think that this is a big claim that requires a large leap, but you have to admit that something else other than what we were told by the official record was going on in the theater that day. Evidence shows Lee Oswald did not have enough time to reach 10th and Patton on foot in the first place. Moreover, witnesses placed him in the Texas Theater at the time of the Tippit shooting. Four questions come to mind. Who really shot J.D. Tippit? Why was he shot? Who was the person who looked like Lee Oswald that Johnny Brewer saw enter the theater at about 1:35? Finally, if Oswald could have traveled the 10 blocks between his rooming house at 1026 North Beckley and the Tippit murder site in 5 to 10 minutes, why would it supposedly have taken him half an hour to get from the shooting site at 10th and Patton to the Texas Theater at 231 West Jefferson Boulevard, a distance of only 7 blocks? Johnny Brewer pointed out to the police where Lee Oswald was sitting. The police, however, did not go directly toward him. Rather, they slowly started at the front of the theater as if waiting for him trying to escape. After several minutes, they reached where he was seated. Officer Nick McDonald approached him and told him to stand. Oswald stood up and shouted, quote, "Well, this is it," end quote. He hauled off and floored Officer McDonald with one punch to the face, allegedly drew a revolver from his waistband of his slacks, pulled the trigger, and fired at McDonald point blank. McDonald reached out for the gun, and the webbing between his thumb and his forefinger slid between the firing pin and the bullet shell, preventing the primer from being struck and saving his life. Other police officers jumped into the fray, and Lee Oswald was subdued. He shouted that he was not resisting arrest and screamed, quote, "Police brutality," end quote. At the time of Oswald's arrest, Johnny Brewer heard at least one of the arresting officers shout, quote, "Kill the president, will you," end quote. However, at this point, the police had no reason to suspect Oswald's involvement in the assassination. Any members of the Dallas police drawing a connection between Lee Oswald and the assassination at this point must have been part of a conspiracy. It would be half an hour before he was even a suspect in the murder of the president, and 10 more hours before he was charged in that crime. Only two of the people in the theater audience were even questioned by the Warren Commission. George Applin, who was sitting six rows from the rear of the theater when the lights came on and the arrest began, testified in 1964. He says, quote, "There is one thing puzzling me, and I don't know if it has any bearing on the case, but there was one guy sitting in the back row where I was standing at, and I said to him, I said, quote, buddy, you better move, there is a gun, end quote. And he says, just sit there." Applin told the Warren Commission that he didn't know who the man in the theater on November 22, 1963 was, but he did know who he was 2 days after the assassination. In 1979, Applin confessed to the Dallas Morning News that he in fact had recognized the man who had been in the theater as Jack Ruby. But we also have people at this time that placed Jack Ruby at Parkland Hospital. Man, what a rabbit hole this is. Applin would go on to say, quote, "I was afraid. I'm a pretty nervous guy anyway. After I saw that magazine article where all those people had come up dead, it kind of made me keep a low profile." I'm sure Jack Ruby was the man I saw in the Texas theater at the time of Oswald's arrest. He was just sitting down, just watching them. And when Oswald pulled the gun and it snapped at Officer McDonald's head and missed, the darn thing wouldn't have fired. And when Oswald pulled the gun and snapped it at Officer McDonald's head, that's when I tapped Ruby on the shoulder and told him he better move because those guns were waving around. He just turned around and looked at me and said, quote, "Just sit there," end quote. Then he turned around and started watching them try to apprehend Oswald. Applin learned who Jack Ruby was when his picture was published 2 days after Oswald's murder. Did Oswald go to the Texas Theater to meet Jack Ruby or someone else? Was he set up by a double who led authorities to the theater? Was Oswald supposed to be shot while trying to escape by the police or by Ruby? The official report states that Lee Oswald entered the theater at 1:45 p.m. and that by 1:51 p.m. he was under arrest and placed in the back seat of a police car and was being driven to the police station on Main Street in downtown Dallas. He was fingerprinted by Lieutenant K.P. Knight and formal arrest photos were taken. Like I stated before, the original homicide report of the Tippit murder read, quote, "Suspect was later arrested in the balcony of the Texas Theater at 231 West Jefferson," end quote. This, of course, contradicts the fact that Oswald was arrested in the downstairs section of the theater. The official police report indicates that there was only one arrest at the theater that day, but we know from talking to witnesses this was not true. Let's do a quick overview, shall we? The Warren report describes the murder of Officer Tippit at approximately 1:15 p.m. after he confronted a man walking east along the south side of Patton Avenue. The man's general description was similar to the one broadcast over the police radio just minutes before. Tippit stopped the man and called him to his car. He approached the car and apparently exchanged words with Tippit through the right front or vent window. Tippit got out and started to walk around the front of his car. As Tippit reached the left front wheel, the man pulled out a revolver and fired several shots. Three bullets hit Tippit in the chest and one hit him in his right temple and killed him instantly. The gunman started back toward Patton Avenue, ejecting the empty cartridge cases before reloading with fresh bullets. As the gunman walked and trotted away from the murder scene while still holding the revolver, the Warren report says that he was seen by at least 12 people. By the evening of November 22nd, five of them had identified Lee Harvey Oswald in police lineups as the man they saw. A sixth did so the next day. Three others subsequently identified Oswald from a photograph. Two witnesses testified that Oswald resembled the man they had seen. One witness felt he was too distant from the gunman to make a positive identification. The fleeing man, identified later as Lee Oswald, was seen finally by Johnny Brewer, manager of Hardy's Shoe Store, located a few doors east of the Texas Theater. After spotting the man acting suspiciously in the recessed area in the front of the store, Brewer went outside. He saw the man ducking into the Texas Theater up the block. The ticket seller, Julia Postal, confirmed to Brewer that the man had not bought a ticket. She called the police. However, the man who shot Tippit fled the murder scene and sneaked into the Texas Theater just before 1:45 p.m. and was identified as Lee Harvey Oswald posed another bi-location problem. Oswald once again seemed to be in two places at the same time. According to Butch Burroughs, the concession stand operator at the Texas Theater, Lee Harvey Oswald entered the theater sometime between 1 p.m. and 1:07 p.m., several minutes before Officer Tippit was slain seven blocks away. If true, Butch Burroughs' observation would eliminate Oswald as a candidate for Tippit's murder. Perhaps for that reason, Burroughs was asked by a Warren Commission attorney the apparently straightforward question, quote, "Did you see Oswald come into the theater?" end quote. Burroughs answered honestly, quote, "No, sir, I didn't," end quote. What someone reading this testimony would not know is that Butch Burroughs was unable to see anyone enter the theater from where he was standing at his concession stand unless that person came into the area where he was working. As he explained to me in an interview, there was a partition between his concession stand and the front door. Someone could enter the theater, go directly up a flight of stairs to the balcony, and not be seen from the concession stand. That, Burrow said, is what Oswald apparently did. However, Burrow still knew Oswald had come into the theater between 1 p.m. and 1:07 p.m. because he saw him inside the theater soon after that. As he told me, he sold popcorn to Oswald at 1:15 p.m., information that the Warren Commission did not solicit from his testimony. When Oswald bought his popcorn at 1:15 p.m., this was exactly the same time the Warren Commission said that Officer Tippett was being shot to death, evidently by someone else. Butch Burroughs was not alone in noticing Oswald in the Texas Theater by 1:07 p.m. The man who would soon be identified as the president's assassin drew the attention of several moviegoers because of his odd behavior. Edging into a row of seats in the right rear section of the ground floor, Oswald squeezed in front of an 18-year-old named Jack Davis. He then sat down in the seat right next to him. Because there were fewer than 20 people in the entire 900-seat theater, Davis wondered why the man chose to sit so close to him. Whatever the reason, the man didn't stay there long. Oswald, as Davis would later identify him, got up quickly, moved across the aisle, and sat down next to someone else in almost a deserted theater. In a few moments, he stood up again and walked out to the lobby. Davis thought it was obvious that Oswald was looking for someone. Yet it must have been someone he didn't know personally. He sat next to each person just long enough to receive a prearranged signal, in the absence of which he moved on to another possible contact. Back out in the lobby at 1:15 p.m., Oswald then bought popcorn from Butch Burroughs at the concession stand. Burroughs told author Jim Mars and myself that he saw Oswald go back in the ground floor of the theater and sit next to a pregnant woman in another apparently fruitless effort to find his contact. Several minutes later, Burroughs said, quote, "The pregnant woman got up and went to the ladies' restroom. He heard the restroom door close shortly before Dallas police came rushing into the theater." Jack Davis said it may have been 20 minutes or so after Oswald returned from the lobby, when Burroughs saw Oswald sit by the pregnant woman, that the house lights came on and the police rushed in. The police arrested Oswald in a curious way. They entered the theater from the front and back, blocking all exits and surrounding Oswald. Officer Nick McDonald and three other officers came in from behind the movie screen. With the theater lights on, McDonald scanned the audience. Johnny Brewer, who had seen the man who looked like Oswald duck into the theater, showed McDonald where the man was sitting, in the third row from the rear of the ground floor. With the suspect identified and located, McDonald and another officer, instead of apprehending the man in the rear of the theater, began searching people between him and them. As the police proceeded slowly towards Oswald, it was almost as if they were provoking the suspected police killer to break away from his seat. His attempt to escape would have given Tippett's enraged fellow officers an excuse to shoot him. When McDonald finally reached his suspect in the third row from the back, Oswald stood up and pulled out his pistol. While he struggled with McDonald and the other officers who had converged on the scene, they heard the snap of the hammer on his gun misfiring. However, Oswald, instead of being shot to death on the spot, was wrestled into submission by the police and placed under arrest. The police hustled him out to a squad car. They drove him to Dallas Police Headquarters in City Hall. Butch Burroughs, who witnessed Oswald's arrest, startled me in his interview by saying he saw his second arrest occur in the Texas Theater only 3 or 4 minutes later. He said the Dallas police then arrested, quote, "an Oswald lookalike," end quote. Burroughs said the second man looked almost identical to Oswald, like he was his brother or something. When I questioned the comparison by asking, could you see the second man as well as you could see Oswald? He said, yes, I could see both of them. They looked just alike. After the officers half carried and half dragged Oswald to the police car in front of the theater, within a space of 3 or 4 minutes, Burroughs saw the second Oswald, placed under arrest and handcuffed. The Oswald look-alike, however, was taken by police not out the front door, but out the back of the theater. What happened next we can learn from another neglected witness, Bernard Hare. He was the owner of Bernie's Hobby House, just 2 doors east of the Texas Theater. Hare went outside his store when he saw police congregating in front of the theater. When he couldn't see what was happening because of the crowd, he went back through his store into the alley out back. It too was full of police cars, but there were fewer spectators. Hare walked up the alley. When he stopped opposite the rear door of the theater, he witnessed what he would think for decades was the arrest of Lee Harvey Oswald. Hare said, quote, "Police brought out a young white man. This man was dressed in a pullover shirt and slacks. He seemed to be flushed as if he had been in a struggle. Police put the man in the police car and drove off," end quote. When Hare was told years later that Lee Harvey Oswald had been brought out the front of the theater, he was shocked. "I don't know who I saw arrested," he said in bewilderment. Butch Burroughs and Bernard Hare are complimentary witnesses. From their perspectives, both inside and outside the Texas theater, they saw an Oswald double arrested and taken to a police car in the back alley only minutes after the arrest of Lee Harvey Oswald. Burroughs and Hare's independent, converging testimonies provide critical insight into the mechanics of the plot. In a comprehensive intelligence scenario for Kennedy and Tippit's murders, the plan culminated in Oswald's Friday arrest and Sunday murder. His Sunday murder in the Dallas police basement was probably a fallback plan from being set up to be killed in the Texas theater by police. There is a hint of the second Oswald's arrest in the Dallas police records. According to the Dallas Police Department's official homicide report on J.D. Tippit, quote, "suspect was later arrested in the balcony of the Texas Theater at 231 West Jefferson," end quote. Dallas Police Detective L.D. Stringfellow also reported to Captain W.P. Gannaway, quote, "Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested in the balcony of the Texas Theater," end quote. To whom are the homicide report and Detective Stringfellow referring? Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested on the bottom floor, not the balcony. Are these documents referring to the Dallas Police Department's second arrest at the Texas Theater that afternoon? Was Butch Burroughs witnessing an arrest of the Oswald lookalike that actually began in the balcony? That would have likely been the double's hiding place after he entered the theater without paying, thereby drawing attention to himself and leading the police to the apprehension of his likeness, Lee Harvey Oswald, who was already inside. As Butch Burroughs pointed out, anyone coming in the front of the theater could head immediately up the stairs to the balcony without being seen from the concession stand. The Oswald double, after being put in the police car in the alley, must have been driven a short distance and released on higher intelligence orders. Unfortunately for the plotters, he was seen again soon. With the scapegoat, Lee Harvey Oswald, now safely in custody, we can presume that the double was not supposed to be seen again in Dallas or anywhere else. Had he not been seen, the CIA's double Oswald strategy in Oak Cliff shell game might have eluded independent investigators forever. But thanks to other key witnesses who have emerged, we now have detailed evidence that the double was seen again, not just once, but twice. At 2 p.m., as Lee Harvey Oswald sat handcuffed in the back seat of a patrol car, boxed in by police officers on his way to jail, Oswald knew what final role had been chosen for him in the assassination scenario. That night, while being led through police headquarters, he would shout out to the press, quote, "I'm just a patsy," end quote. Also at about 2 p.m., a man identified as Oswald was seen in a car 8 blocks away from the Texas Theater, still very much at large and keeping a low profile. A sharp-eyed auto mechanic spotted him. T.F. White was a 60-year-old longtime employee of Mac Pate's Garage in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas. While White worked on an automobile the afternoon of the assassination, he could hear police sirens screaming up and down Davis Street only a block away. He also heard radio reports describing a suspect then thought to be in Oak Cliff. The mechanic looked out the open doors of the garage. He watched as a red 1961 Falcon drove into the parking lot of the El Chico restaurant across the street. The Falcon parked in an odd position after going a few feet into the lot. The driver remained seated in the car. White said later, quote, "the man in the car appeared to be hiding," end quote. White kept his eye on the man in the Falcon. When Mac Pate returned from his lunch break a few minutes later, T.F. White pointed out to his boss the oddly parked Falcon with its waiting driver who seemed to be hiding. Pate told White to watch the car carefully, reminding him of earlier news reports that they had heard about a possible assassination attempt against President Kennedy in Houston the day before involving a red Falcon. T.F. White walked across the street to investigate. He halted about 10 to 15 yards from the car. He could see the driver was wearing a white t-shirt. The man turned toward White and looked at him full face. White stared back at him. Not wanting to provoke a possible assassin, White began a retreat to the garage. However, he took out a scrap piece of paper from his coveralls pocket and wrote down the Texas license plate of the car, PP4537. That night, while T.F. White was watching television with his wife, he recognized the Dallas Police Department's prisoner, Lee Harvey Oswald, as the man he had seen in the Red Falcon in El Chico's parking lot. White was unfazed, but what he did not yet know, that at the same time he had seen one Oswald sitting freely in the Falcon, the other Oswald was sitting handcuffed in a Dallas police car on his way to jail. Mrs. White, fearing what might happen to her husband if he told authorities what he saw, talked her husband out of reporting this information to authorities. The most compelling reports of a second Oswald in Dallas that weekend in November of 1963 comes from Robert G. Vinson of the North American Air Defense Command, otherwise known as NORAD. Vinson not only saw the second Oswald on the afternoon of November 22nd, soon after T.F. White did, he actually witnessed the Oswald double escaping from Dallas in a CIA plane. Sergeant Vinson was already on the CIA getaway plane when the second Oswald boarded it. Vinson also got off the plane at the same CIA base as Oswald's double did, a few minutes after him. Robert Vinson is a unique witness to the CIA's secret movement of an Oswald double out of Dallas on the afternoon of the assassination. Vinson would describe the man as 5'7 to 5'9 inches tall, weighing about 150 to 160 pounds, and was Caucasian with dark hair. When Vinson watched the televised events from Dallas later that weekend, he recognized Lee Harvey Oswald as identical to the man he had seen board the plane. By the next morning, Saturday, November 23, 1963, Robert Vinson was at home in Colorado Springs telling his wife Roberta the story of his strange flight. Although they didn't understand what lay behind it all, they both felt it could be dangerous. They agreed not to discuss it with anyone else. That night, while watching the TV coverage from Dallas, Robert shook his head in disbelief. He said to his wife, quote, "That guy looks exactly like the guy who was on my airplane," end quote. "Are you nuts?" she said. "It couldn't be him. He's in jail." Vincent says, quote, "I swear, that's the guy who got on the plane," end quote. His wife Roberta then told him to keep quiet about it. After Lee Harvey Oswald was murdered the following day, Robert Vinson kept quiet for 30 years about the Oswald double he saw get on the plane in Dallas. Robert Vinson has said that since November 22, 1963, he says, quote, "Every time I see an article on the assassination, I stop and wonder if I had the answer to this puzzle. Could this small piece of information fit into a larger picture to help us learn what happened?" End quote. Thanks to the pieces of information presented by auto mechanic T.F. White, concession stand operator Butch Burroughs, hobby shop owner Bernard Hare, and Air Force Sergeant Robert Vinson, we now have a larger picture of the way in which two men played the role of Lee Harvey Oswald in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas on the afternoon of November 22, 1963. The interlocking testimonies of White, Burroughs, Hare, and Vinson have given us a backstage view of the double Oswald drama directed by the CIA. Over the past seven episodes, we've sifted through witness accounts, timelines, ballistic reports, and conflicting testimonies, all in pursuit of the truth behind the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit. Next time on The End of Innocence, I'll give you my final conclusion. After examining a mountain of evidence, it's time to answer the question, did Lee Harvey Oswald really kill Officer J.D. Tippit? Don't miss it. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com.